This is With Dignity, the story of Casey House, episode 2. The house was open, and they were ready to invite in their first patients, or in Casey House vernacular, clients. Here's Linda Rapson.
Well, the famous story of the first person being brought there by ambulance was the ambulance people coming in with the full, you know, hazmat gear.
And a member of Casey House rushed out to greet him.
And I don't know if she kissed him, but she, you know, touched him and welcomed him.
In the words of longtime Casey House volunteer, the playwright and novelist Timothy Finley, maybe you've heard of him, quote, "Maskless, gloveless, and bare-armed, leaned in over him, brushed back his hair, and said, 'Welcome to Casey House. I'm Kathleen, and I will be with you every day.'"
And then the ambulance guys sheepishly removed their protection, is what the story is. And I think it's a true story. Because, you know, it took a while, I have to say it. I mean, I was nervous too, until I began to realize that, you know, I'm not going to get this. This is nuts. And so once you get used to it, then you're perfectly comfortable anywhere in the house.
The red brick kind of stood out in that neighborhood. And there was a walnut occasional table set up in a corner, highly polished. And there was this massive candle on it. But I'd get to know that candle quite well. What I didn't realize at the time was that every time a patient died, that candle was lit. So yeah, I got to light that candle a lot.
That is Jim Donovan. Jim was a nurse at Casey House for 35 years. He started in Casey House's first year in November of 1988 and retired in 2023. When Jim was just training to be a nurse, he encountered a patient with HIV/AIDS for the first time.
I remember working with this particular person, and they were so matter of fact about their illness and about the fact that they would die soon. It was astounding the calmness with which they spoke about it. So at the end of every clinical day, we did a clinical recap with the instructor. And I remember my turn came around, so I started enthusing about connecting with this person and talking with them and bringing their meal tray in that was always left outside their door. And the instructor at the end of it said, "But why would you want to waste your time on these people?" And that's when it came to me. It was like a blinding flash of light. These people are the ones that I'm going to care for.
But there wasn't a dedicated hospital or hospice for people with AIDS. So Jim worked in standard hospitals after school. Then one day, he happened to notice a doctor's shirt during rounds.
She was wearing a t-shirt with a huge heart on it and said, "Casey House." And I asked her about it after rounds, and she told me, "It's just up the street. It's a hospice for people with AIDS." And I thought, this is the place.
And just a few days later, he was walking into that red brick building for an interview.
I thought this would be like a very formal interview. It was very laid back. Did a tour of the unit, which completely impressed me. I mean, not only was the physical unit set up for the provision of comfort and the focus on comfort, but staff attitudes were as well. It was alive, is the one adjective I would use to describe it. The usual sterility and efficiency of a hospital unit didn't exist there. So I'm looking at beds that have wood headboards and footboards, and I'm looking at full-length drapes on every window. There's fireplaces in some of the rooms. People are being served meals in a small kitchen area. There's a tub that, lo and behold, actually works and is being enjoyed by clients. There was a huge living room with a huge TV and volunteers doing things like playing cards, taking people out for walks. And the staff, the pace was slower, like people breathed. It wasn't like what I was used to at Toronto General Hospital, was just the frantic dashing about. So I thought, I've got to get on board with this.
Jim joined the team. Soon after, he and the nursing staff were taking in patients that were much sicker than they'd initially planned for.
We didn't understand or know much about pain. We didn't anticipate the extreme pain that clients would come to us in. Our stock drug supplies would have fit into a modest wardrobe. We had Tylenol extra strength. Yeah, Tylenol for excruciating deep bone pain.
They were coming from settings where their needs weren't being met.
And we had one fellow admitted who came to us from a care facility. And I was down there with a physician and a student physician. And the doctor said, okay, can you turn him toward you so I can listen to his air entry? So I did. And I saw the doctor just kind of froze. And the student stumbled back a few steps and collapsed. And I thought, oh my God, what are we looking at here? The doctor motioned me over, and this poor fellow, from his shoulder blades down to his tailbone, it was one huge scab.
The Casey house they had planned had to adjust. Some of the amenities just weren't realistic in practice. Here's Jim and Linda.
We had it in our heads for some silly reason that people were going to be capable of getting out of bed and going to the dining room.
This dining room. It was all done up very Victorian, pale green walls, table set up for two with linen, cloth napkins, silverware, wine glasses, the dumb waiter that would bring the hot meals from the kitchen up to the dining room on the first floor.
There's an elevator if you needed an elevator, that kind of thing. But it was never used.
None of it ended up being able to be used.
They couldn't. They were too sick.
Because, I mean, we, or maybe the planners, had not taken into account just how sick people were, that people couldn't get out of bed, that people maybe couldn't eat, that maybe even a spoonful of Jell-O was it for the day, that people were struggling with issues around incontinence that would just hit them and drive them back to their bathroom in shame.
They had to have their food brought to them in their rooms.
So it became the jack of all trades and the master of all of them as well. It became a community learning room, but then within half an hour, it could become a party room for a client's birthday. And then it would become a room for prayers of remembrance.
One part of the house they got right was on the second floor. They installed a hydraulic bathtub that had been donated. It was massive, with jets and a lift that would lower a patient in on a stretcher horizontally.
And I saw it a couple of times. Patients that came to us, when they were given a tub bath, would cry in delight, in the humiliation of not having had a bath for so long, in the refreshment of it. Yeah, June got that totally right.
Most rooms were singles, but there were a couple of double rooms where clients would have a roommate.
Some clients would say, I can't be in this room because I can't look at this person because that's, I know what's going to happen to me. I can't witness that.
But other times, putting two clients together worked out beautifully.
We had a double room, and the first admission into there was a quiet fellow from Nova Scotia. And his new roommate was profoundly disturbed, crying out in the night, getting up, falling, that sort of thing. And I can remember the nurses coming on for the night shift were kind of saying, well, maybe we'll have someone sit outside the room because we don't want to scare him with someone sitting beside his bed, but we'll be there. And, you know, this must be rough on his roommate. There wasn't anything heard going into the night shift. So one of the nurses, Kathleen, went in to see, and she thought, oh my God, like maybe he has died. And there, sitting in the lamplight, was the initial admission, the roommate, sitting there with his arm around this fellow's shoulders, feeding him a popsicle. So we learned about the little things that meant so much.
And as they knew there would be, there were deaths.
People came in so ill The median stay at that time could be measured in days or weeks. I remember we had someone who, when they lasted 3 months, that was like quite a milestone. And we actually celebrated the length of their stay with a cake for them.
And one long weekend, we had 5 deaths over the long weekend.
Like a volunteer put it to me quite eloquently, they had finished a run of shifts, and it seemed like almost every shift they were on, there was a death. He told me walking home one night, going through, it was Cawthra Park at the time, and he said he just was so overcome by the immensity of this and by, to him, the unfairness of it, that he just screamed at the sky, you know, like, God, isn't this enough? And I thought, you know what? That is the question. That is the question that we have to ask. That is the question we need to deal with ourselves. You know, does it ever stop? Basically, we wrote the book on HIV/AIDS care because nobody knew anything. We didn't have anything to go by. There were no instructions. There was no template. There was no, if you do this, this will happen.
Well, we had no blueprint, I think was the word we were using. We had none. And we tried to bring common sense to it. We wanted them to be treated with respect, and we wanted them to be comfortable. We wanted them to feel they were accepted by everybody. That kind of thing was very, very important. And people, within a very short time, they knew that they were in a different kind of place than a standard hospital.
They had a shared set of principles, providing comfort, dignity, and autonomy. But that was easier said than done.
One of the things that the clinical staff prided themselves on absolutely was no one should be in pain. Now, I mean, that's a very high goal to reach for, but reach for it. I had to learn client autonomy, and that would be a resounding lesson all during the course of my career there. But if a client wanted to do something, that was their right to do it. From as simple as having a bowl of porridge with high fat cream in it, even though it always made them so sick afterwards. That's what they wanted. That's what they enjoyed. And my preaching about skim milk was for naught. The whole idea, no one dies alone, that was a little bit of, I think, a fiction that we got caught up in. It sounds very passionate, but many times people do die alone. And it's beyond us. There's nothing that we really can do about it. Or people die under not humorous circumstances, but it can be a bit disconcerting. I mean, we had one admission come in, and their thing was, as soon as they got to the front porch, this was a lovely summer day, I want a cigarette. Cigarettes figured big because people can't smoke in hospital. And they knew they could when they came to Casey House. And he wanted to sit out on the porch and have a cigarette. So two nurses set him up to do this. And he died right there. He didn't even finish his cigarette. So in their, I guess, consternation, like, you know, nobody should die on a porch, they bundled him up and got him on the elevator, very tiny, tiny elevator. And they had him standing up between them, brought him up to the room that he was going to be admitted in, and got him into the bed, and then called the doctor to pronounce him. So things like that.
And even with all of the care and thought and compassion of Casey House, AIDS brought with it all sorts of challenging symptoms.
Dementia figured quite big, and sometimes it could be aggressive, but we also needed to prepare and to be able to support people through the anxiety, the angst, the fear, well, fear, terror. Some people died in terror because the way they had been brought up, and usually was people of a very deeply religious background, was that their lifestyle was sinful. And their lifestyle basically had committed them to hell. And when they were dying, That's all they knew. And they were fighting tooth and nail not to die. I guess it confirmed in me that there had to be more to life than just this, that these fine men and women were not just simply dying, and their potential, their gifts to community for nothing.
The Casey House team could adjust their client care. They could adjust the house to suit their needs, but one thing that they couldn't adjust was the elevator. It was too small to fit a patient on a stretcher, and several of the rooms were on the second floor. So, Casey House called, and Michael Oscars and the DQ team answered again.
And then the next need was they needed an elevator in the house. So we ended up right away having had also the most extraordinary time doing the show. So we ended up doing a sequel, calling it DQ88 The Sequin. And sadly, everybody in the show, or I would say 95% of all the performers passed. So many of them were sick or eventually developed the disease. We had one very sick kid who just couldn't continue with the show. I had no choice. I said, the show has to go on. And I had to make the decision, you need to go home and look after yourself. Kid passed. I remember his partner came up to me and said thank you, because that was some of the best days of his life he had. The best time. There were, lots of very happy moments when a number was, oh my God, we got it, we got it. Everybody was in step. Silly basic things like that. There was a camaraderie that can only happen in a setting like that. There was a lot of gallows humor. And when you're in a DQ show, you're in a community. I mean, front and back, everybody's equal.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming tonight. And please take care of yourself and each other.
We raised the money for the elevator because the elevator went in.
DQ88 was another huge success. They got their elevator. Nancy Rowe Lussier was really young when her dad got sick.
We didn't know what was wrong, and he wouldn't tell us what was wrong. For him, I think he was struggling personally. He was, I think, very ashamed of who he was, which is so unfortunate, but he didn't feel like he really fit. And I think that that's what trickled over into him keeping isolated and keeping a very private life.
After her parents separated, Nancy's dad, Ken, was still present in her life, but contact was inconsistent. Then one day, Nancy and her siblings noticed they hadn't had contact with him for quite a while.
We had been calling and trying to reach him for a considerable amount of time. And finally, we had a phone call back from a social worker who had been trying to help him. And they let us know that he was at the Toronto General Hospital.
His kids rushed down to see him and visited as much as they could while he was in the hospital.
We were with him for weeks, just coming to visit and just trying to make that connection, let him know that his family was here.
But even in the hospital, Nancy's dad wouldn't tell his family what was going on.
And he wouldn't allow the doctors, even though we would plead with them, please tell us what's happening. They were, of course, bound by privacy and couldn't tell us. Then he left the hospital but he didn't let us know where he was going. And this is where it became very painful, because we went actually a few weeks without knowing where he was. We knew he wasn't at his apartment because we had been calling.
And finally, a family friend told her that her dad was at Casey House.
I called Casey House and I said, you know, I know my dad is there. I'm coming to see him. And of course, they weren't able to give me any information. But Aileen was the person on the other end of the line at Casey House, who's a marvelous person and managed the situation very well, because of course it was a very emotional time and a very emotional phone call. And she went and spoke with him. She put me on hold. She didn't acknowledge if he was there or not, but she put me on hold. And then she came back and said, he's here and you can come. And I was able to see him that day.
Wow. Do you remember that first day walking into Casey House?
I will never forget the first day I walked in to Casey House. I went through the doors, and the first thing I saw was a beautiful bouquet of flowers, and it was very home-like. It was a calm place because I felt I was coming in with a lot of emotion, a lot of questions, and just wondering how he could be here without us knowing. And so when I walked through the doors, I was greeted right away. There were staff waiting for me, just wanting to make sure that they could ease the situation as much as possible.
Nancy's dad was a client at Casey House, which answered a few of her questions.
And then, of course, as soon as I saw my dad, I was just in tears because, you know, how could you be here and not tell us? We were all with you, and we want to be with you. So it was tough. I would visit as much as I could, not as much as I wish I could have. I was at university at the time, so trying to juggle being in university, but also being there for him. We found out the middle of October then that my dad was at Casey House, and staff went to a lot of effort to bring his family together. They planned a special meal for us. That is one of my most vivid memories of all of us coming in, the five kids, and we were at a table of six. My dad was at the head of the table, head of food services at Casey House, prepared a meal. And they had a volunteer there who served us like we were at a fine restaurant. And they went to so much effort to make this the most stable but beautiful moment for us to come together, because it wasn't easy. And it really just started us off knowing, like, there is a lot of dignity and a lot of respect being shown to the people here and also to us, and that there's support there and there's people who are there trying to hold us up. I do remember my dad's first social worker, one of the comments she made to me was that this was the first time they had managed with children coming in, and not that people didn't have children, but we were the first family that had kids coming through the doors.
So at this point, Casey House had been open for 2 or 3 years. They were experienced in a lot of ways, but there was still this element of making it up as they went along.
So when some things would crop up, a comment was made is that we're just learning as we go. This is new territory for us. And what I think about that memory is that we were part of the learning process and the establishing of Casey House. And you do feel reassured because there's a lot of honesty. So if something's happening, this is just what's happening, and we'll just try and deal with it.
Ken arrived in October of 1991. So he was still a brand new resident at the house when the big news broke. Princess Diana was coming to visit Casey House. That's next time.